Yeah, so this is the work that I did with
Madhu Gopinathan, who was an intern of mine from the Indian Institute of Science.
The first part of this talk is a paper that got accepted in RV, Runtime Verification 08, which is going on right now, along with ETAPS. And then I'll present the more recent work.
Presumably someone else is presenting.
Yeah, Madhu was presenting. Hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah. So, some of my earlier speakers made my job a little bit easier, you know. Safra's went on that for binary trees. That's quite useful for me.
You have to be careful of the interference between this and your mic. Just don't go nuts.
Okay. So this talk is about stating and checking object invariants. And so what are object invariants? As Safra was just saying, you know, you could have objects where one object points to other objects, and then you can have invariants that might depend on not only the current object, but it might depend upon the fields of other objects too. So for example, an invariant of a binary search tree would say that, you know, the key field that you have, you know, is related to the key fields of the left and right. And what might happen is that you might have a pointer, k1, that points to the key, and you might just inadvertently just change that field. And when you do that, you are actually breaking the invariant of n1, which is pointing to the key field. And unless you're careful, these kinds of errors are very difficult to detect and debug in object-oriented programs. I'll show you more examples. You know, if you think that, you know, binary search trees are just academic, I'll show you a couple of things from JDBC and another Java library. Here, you have something called a connection. Let me just see if I have it. Then you have a connection which connects to a database, and then there's a statement that we create from the connection. So internally, a statement has some dependency on the connection. And the invariant of the statement is that if the statement is not closed, you know, the connection should also not be closed. But, you know, but you have an independent point at the connection, and then the programmer can just close the connection, and that breaks the invariant of the statement. I'll give you one more. This you could have an ArrayList, which is a collection class, and for that you could actually create an iterator, which, you know, depends on the list. And an invariant of that is that the version number of the iterator has to be the same as the version number of the list. And what that means is that when you're looping through the iterator, if you modify the list, then you are changing the list's version number. And that can break this invariant. And for reasons that are unknown to me, this is called the concurrent modification exception, CME, which has nothing to do with concurrency. But you get the idea. I mean, there's lots of situations where objects point to other objects, and if you change one of them, you break the invariance of other objects. So our goal is to come up with a runtime scheme to monitor object invariants. And one of the things we want to do is to guarantee to detect invariant violations when they happen. That's one of the things we want to do. So there's two issues in building such a monitor. One of them is that it's not entirely clear when an object's invariant holds, because, you know, you have to break it when you, for instance, have to fix up the object. There are situations when the object invariant actually does not hold. And the other thing is something that I alluded to already, because when you change the contents of one object, you might be breaking the invariants of other objects that point to this object. So what are we going to do? We are going to set up the monitor separately from the program, and you're going to describe the monitor using some notation. You're going to use something like a role, which is like an interface, but it also will enable me to add auxiliary state to objects. So I'm going to start with one auxiliary field called I and V, which conceptually tells me when the object invariant holds. Right? So think about this extra state as auxiliary state that I'm going to add to every object that, you know, conforms to this role. And when the I and V bit is true, you know, I deem that the actual object invariant, O.IND, holds. Okay? Then, you know, the one problem is that, well, an object also depends on other dependents, so it turns out that it's convenient for me to also keep track of what all other objects depend on this object role. Then what we're going to do is that we're going to define some methods over this auxiliary state, which tells me how this auxiliary state gets manipulated. For example, when an object gets created, we're going to set O.IND to false, and its dependence to null. When we want to assert that the object is now in a stable state, we are going to call this method check and set inv that asserts o.inv and sets o.inv to true. Okay. Then we want to add a dependency between object O and P. We will call this method that adds O to P's dependence. Okay. So I mean, basically, what we're doing is that I've set up some auxiliary state and I've given you some methods on how to update this auxiliary state. And my goal is to keep satisfying this global invariant. That whenever this INV boolean is true, I want the actual object invariant to hold. Okay? So I gave you these three, I'm going to give you two more. But I want to start, when I want to say that the object is in a stable state, I'll call this method, which says that initially my o.inv is false, but now I assert that it's true. And this one actually, you know, asserts it and then checks it. Similarly, when I want to stop monitoring the object invariant, I'll call the dual method. And I'm going to have one more, which says, you know, when validate P is called, I want to check for all the objects that are in the dependence of P that the object invariant holds. So, barring the details, what I've given is that I've added some auxiliary state, and I've given you some methods that manipulate the auxiliary state. And my goal is to make sure that this invariant holds. Okay? So, now, how is this auxiliary state actually connected to the actual program? Conceptually, you could think about it as the programmer inserting calls at appropriate points inside the program. For example, in the connection statement example here, as soon as the connection is created, somehow magically, assume that the programmer calls init and start. Okay. Similarly, after statement is created, he calls init, and then since there's a dependency between connection and statement, the add call is made, and now I'm going to start monitoring the invariant of statement. So you could assume that somehow magically these calls are introduced. Then what would happen is that when the connection is closed, because this validator is called, and because we have added a dependency between connection and statement, at this point, you would actually check for all dependents of connection, whether the invariant holds. And the dependency between connection and statement would be detected, and the invariant would be violation would be detected. But this is not satisfactory because, you know, what if the programmer forgets to add these things? Or what if the programmer forgets to call these things at the right time? So what we're going to do is that we're going to automate the process of doing this instrumentation, right? So what we're going to do is that let's start with something really simple. We're going to say that whenever an object is created, we'll call init O. Whenever the public method of O is entered, we will stop monitoring the object's invariant because, you know, we now think that the object's invariant will be broken for some time. Whenever the public method is exited, we will stop monitoring it again. And the last one is the hardest one. Whenever O or any of its dependents change, let me call validator O. And that's a hard one because there's nowhere in the program you can know what O's dependents are. They are not recorded anywhere. So here is where the first innovation that we do comes in. We define a relation D, which is triples, which says that a triple OPF is in D if the object invariant of O depends on P.F. And my intern Madhu is a whiz in using AspectJ. And so he figured out a way by which this dependency relation can actually be automatically computed during the checking of the object invariant. Right? So conceptually what you can do is actually when object o.inv is executing, using some AspectJ tricks, you can find out what all fields it accesses. And you can compute this dependence relation OPF automatically. And because you can compute this dependence relation automatically, whenever any field changes, you can actually invoke validate automatically. So using these tricks, and I'll skip this example, you can actually show that, maybe I should go to the example. So the way this would work is when the statement is created, you know, because it's created, init is called, and when the public method returns, we start monitoring it. And when you start, the invariant of statement is actually just executed once to see whether it holds. And during the execution of o.inv, since the connection is referenced as part of the invariant, the dependency relation O, P, whatever is automatically tracked by the system. And when the connection is closed, the system knows about this dependency, and it's able to say that the invariant is broken. So there's a theorem in our paper that says that if you keep track of these dependencies this way, you can actually really show that in every run of the program, as long as the auxiliary field water IMV is true, you can ensure that the actual object invariant holds. Okay. And we, by that I really mean Madhu, we implemented this in this tool called INVCOP, which uses AspectJ to compute these dependencies and automatically keep track of these dependencies and do this validation. Maybe I will go through this. So it turns out that this default rules that I mentioned, saying that before every method call, you stop monitoring the invariant. After every public method, start monitoring the invariant. It does not work in all cases. Particularly, it does not work when your methods are when your object is re-entrant. So what do I mean by that? If you have a class T, and you have a method that calls out to some other class, say user, and user, say, calls back to method 2, the problem is that if you stop monitoring the invariant here, you can't guarantee that the invariant actually holds when the control comes back inside the object. So in certain cases, you have to allow the programmer more flexible ways of specifying when to start and stop monitoring the object invariant. And we provide them with ways of doing that. So one of the things that Madhu was able to do was that he was able to apply INVCOP to large Java APIs like JDOM. And he was able to, he looked at invariant violations that, exceptions that were raised, that were posted in news groups and mailing lists and things like that. And they were posted because an object invariant gets violated, but since it does not get detected, it goes undetected for a while. And then it manifests much later. And people don't know what they're doing wrong. And so they post these things in mailing groups, mailing lists saying, I get this exception from this API, what am I doing wrong? So that was one of the goals of his work. And one of the goals of his work was to say that if you actually indeed violate the object invariant, we want to detect it exactly when it happens. And because we track all these dependencies and everything, we should be able to do it. And I'll show you an example of that with JDOM. So what happens in JDOM is that there is some document, and the document, I think, through a sequence of things, it actually creates an iterator. And so this is actually some client of JDOM. And what happens here in this client is that an iterator is created, and during the scope of the iterator, through a sequence of calls, somebody is actually removing something from the list. The invariant is violated at this point itself, because when you are inside the scope of the iterator, you're not supposed to change the list. But it is not detected, because the system doesn't know that there is actually a dependency on this at this point in time. And later, when the next method is called on the iterator, that's actually when the CME is actually raised. So using INVCOP, so if you see this exception, without using our system, this method that actually caused the invariant to be violated is actually not in your stack, because actually it is finished. So that's why actually people have difficulty figuring out, what mistake did I do? But if you use our technique, what happens is that you will get a violation exactly at this point, because our system knows about these dependencies. And if you look at the stack trace that we generate, this remove and detach are actually part of your stack trace, and it can help you. Yes.
Suppose that iterator had become garbage, or we're never going to use it again. Would you still complain about the?
We will complain. We will complain.
So is it true that any time I iterate over a collection and then subsequently any time I use an iterator and then subsequently modify the collection, you're going to complain?
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. What we have to do is that in that case, we need to be careful in writing the invariant of the iterator, saying that if the iterator is not in use anymore, So unless you're careful about the way you write the invariant of the iterator, you can get those kinds of errors as well. Right? So let me show you, the way I would solve the problem is that, you know, we are the ones that write the invariants as well, right? So here I said, you know, the iterator's invariant is that the version number is equal to list.version, right? And I should actually weaken it to say that if I'm not in use, this should be true.
But otherwise, in use, the definition of in use.
I mean, you will have to do something more fancy. Like, for example, if the iterator, I mean, you will have to sort of hook up with the garbage collector or something like that, saying that if it is not being used anymore, you should not check the invariant. Otherwise, you will get those violations.
Okay. It's hard, because you can't predict the future. So, I mean, you can do garbage collection, but other than that.
I agree with you. I think for those kinds of errors to not happen, you will have to hook the system up with the garbage collector. That's the only way to do it. Okay, this is where I thought I would end this talk. But actually, before this, I'll talk a little bit about related work. People have actually built, you know, runtime monitors for object invariants, and we are not the first one to do it. And the most widely used one that I know of is JMM, where you know, Gary Levenson and colleagues have built an invariant checker that actually also check object invariants. But the main difference is that if you actually break an object's invariant due to changing one of its dependents, since it doesn't have the notion of dependencies, it cannot detect them at this point. A more recent work is actually MOP, which actually stands for sort of monitoring oriented programming or something like that, by Grigori Rosu and colleagues at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Let me show you an example of how MOP works. In MOP, what you do is that you specify patterns of what is allowed and what is not allowed. For example, you can say that, now here's a formula which says the only allowed patterns are create followed by any number of next followed by, well, these are actually erroneous patterns. So these are the things that you don't want. I'm sorry. So this is an example of a pattern that you do not. If you find this pattern, then it's an error. This means that you have two occurrences of next, and in the middle you are updating something that you're not supposed to update. That's what this pattern means. Where create is actually bound to all of these things. You know, update source is actually bound to these things, like, you know, add and remove. They are all update source. And next is actually the advancing the next element in the iterator. So if you can declare all these things with MOP, then MOP can detect these kinds of errors as well. But the point that we want to make is that suppose actually the programmer forgets. Thank you. Suppose the programmer forgets to declare the v.remove, right? Then MOP will just miss it, right? Because it relies on the programmer to explicitly specify what the dependencies are. Unlike that in our system monitors and tracks these dependencies automatically. So that's actually the main difference. So in the next couple of minutes, I'll say a little bit about what we're doing with this work currently. We started thinking about these things called object protocols, which I thought I would not present, but actually after I saw Anna's talk, I thought that I should also have the guts to present more object protocols. So I'll say a little bit more about that. What are object protocols? You know, object protocols are, I mean, if you go to Uppsala, they are there in large numbers. Actually, there's two object protocols every Uppsala, I think. The first one I know of was from Clark Potter and Noble. That those are just generic schemas about how to structure interactions between objects. Like the Clark Potter Noble protocol says that every object has an owner, and there are fields like accessed and owner for every object, and there's an invariant about how those are related. And the actual object invariant is actually one tiny part of the object protocol invariant, right? So basically what's happening is that this is actually generic. You know, this one could be instantiated to a node of a binary search tree, for example. But all objects have an owner and all these kinds of things. So what we noticed was that if you want to check object protocols, of course you can actually encode the object protocol also as part of the object invariant itself. And what we found is that if you do this, the checking becomes very inefficient. And I'll show you some numbers for this. And then it turns out that you can actually make mistakes in the protocol description itself that you don't want to detect, specific to something like a binary search tree. You can make mistakes at the level of the protocol itself that you want to detect separately. So what we started doing was that more recently we have actually started stating these object protocols separately, and we have started adding a static analysis scheme on top of this, where we check the object protocol correctness using an SMT solver, and then we check the monitoring using this kind of dependency analysis. And you know, I'll show you some numbers where if you use these complicated object protocols like representation containment, that's the one that Potter Noble, you know, there's the Boogie protocol, there's something called the Friends protocol. As I said, you know, if you go to Oopsla, you'll see a lot of them. We find that our old tool used to take a lot more time. And by adding the static analysis component, we are actually able to reduce the amount of runtime that is overhead that is needed to check these kinds of protocols. In some cases, actually, because of lots of dependencies, they would not even terminate, and we are now able to check these kinds of things. So that's pretty much my talk. I want to just have one advertisement. We are looking for a couple of interns for our group. I'm from India these days. And last summer, we had several students from the United States visit us, and they had a good time. And if you don't believe me, you can see them smiling. So if you have students who would be adventurous enough to come to India for a summer, send them my way. And they can check object invariants together with me and others. So that's my talk. Yeah. So, any questions? Barbara would probably be
able to check. Sure. Yeah. Yes.
So how do you instrument the cursive? Because your method, after your method,
we
put start and stop.
Yeah, so with reentrant code, that's the problem that I mentioned, is that, the problem happens, of course it happens in recursive methods. It could happen even in non-recursive methods when the object is reentrant. In the sense that once you enter a public method, if you say I'm not going to guarantee the invariant anymore, and then you call out and then you call back in, that's a problem. So we have some ways in our tool to override the default ways in which we decide when to monitor and when not to monitor. So more specifically, in this example that I showed you, which I actually went through rather quickly, the correct behavior is that you want to specify that, here you want the object invariant to hold. Even here you want to check it. But at this point, when you call out, you want to assert it again. Right? You want to assert that the object invariant actually holds here. Here the invariant is actually true. And then when it comes back, you want to assert it again. So basically, you can, in our tool, there's some ways by which you can actually go find a granularity and say when all you want the object invariant to hold. And when you have reentrant methods, you need to give programmer the flexibility to say when you want the object invariant to hold.
And then you're back dependent on the programmer to get it right.
Actually, no. So basically, I want to say that if you don't do this right, our system, because it tracks dependencies automatically, is guaranteed to give you an invariant violation, right? So in this, see, the whole point of our system is that this theorem, you can trust us with this theorem. So what would happen is that if you don't specify those things, you might get an invariant violation. Then really you don't have an invariant violation in your program. And then you have to go inside and set up things appropriately, and then you shut up the system.
I actually also wrote the system to satisfy this theorem just now. It just says O.in gets false.
Yeah, so very good question. Very good question. So this theorem, one trivial way to do this is to actually always set O.id to false, right? So the system is effective only if you actually set O.id to true in enough number of places. And by default, right, if you look at our default binding, whenever you start monitoring an object invariant, O.id is actually set to true. So by default, every time you exit the public method of an object, our system would actually set that to true. But you're right. I mean, if you...
So you could also add a liveness condition there to say, and it becomes true infinitely often or something like that, something to give people the idea that giving a strong guarantee there.
That is true. But in practice, what happens is that you do that by setting it to true in enough number of places.
So I have a question related to Steve's question, which is that what this seems to not take into account is that I may have reachable parts of the heap where you may... So my understanding is that you will pick up in your dependence list basically transitively reachable part of the heap.
Whatever INV refers to, we'll pick up.
Right. Okay. So now, there may be genuine situations where there are additional predicates in my code, which when code, I will go look and rely on those invariants of those substructures of the heap, and when that predicate does not hold, I do not go there. So there are portions, I have certain flags and whatnot. It seems like to make this stuff not give you false positives, you will have to essentially duplicate all the logic into your invariant code to make it robust in the sense of not giving too many false positives. Otherwise, you would just report not just this liveness problem that Steve pointed out, but all kinds of other false positives.
And you're right in that, actually, you know, if you don't write the INV method properly, you can get all kinds of problems. But our experience has been, you know, in all these things I showed you, JDOM, you know, we also looked at MySQL and all these things. We were actually able to write INV methods, and we were able to run on big clients that actually gave you errors that matter. Right? So our experience has been that you can actually write invariants in such a way that you can get meaningful messages. But the issue that Steve pointed out, saying that, you know, if I have an invariant, you know, something like an iterator, and after I get out of the scope of the iterator, I might still modify the object. And, you know, that does bother me. And I am actually wondering why this issue did not arise in some of the experiments we did. And there might be some magic Madhu is doing when that I don't completely understand. So I think, you know, when I go back, I'll ask him. I think that when objects get deallocated, he must be doing something. He is a, you know, Java and Aspect J hacker, and he must be doing something that I don't completely know about.
So, actually, I was thinking that, so in the process of recursive methods, right, you don't need to, just for performance optimization, you don't need to do start and stop as you should.
But pardon, what's the question?
You can save your work by not doing the instrumentation for recursive methods, because you can do the runtime stack, you do just the window method returns.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is actually this is just default, and you are free to change it in whatever way you want. I mean, you can change this instrumentation in whatever way you want, but the interesting thing about our system is that because it does dependency tracking automatically, it will actually try and guarantee this invariant, which could be vacuous. You said all this is false, but then you said this to true enough number of times and get benefit out of it. Mike is asking me to go away.